has, because of its unique feeding habits, it's, you know, it's a facultative pollen feeder, it has a very relevant exposure to plant-incorporated protectants. So with that, I'd just like to acknowledge the insectary staff at Pioneer, and Rachel, and Lee, and Jared, who have been instrumental in getting and keeping our little ladybird beetle colony happy. And with that, I would be happy to entertain any questions that you might have. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be protein. I'm not even following my own rules. What's the safe temperature to incorporate proteins into your diet? My answer to that is it's going to be protein dependent. Some proteins are a lot more heat labile than others. You just have to characterize that and try to quantify that. I just don't think there's a blanket answer. Cooler's better. I don't like to incorporate proteins into boiling agar that you've just poured into the mixer and put your diet components in. That's why we use a low melt auger, because the gelling temperature is real low, and so we get it down below 40 C before we even attempt to put it in. So, yeah. Yeah, Tom. The rearing method or the bioassay method? Yeah, you know, I've been talking to Jared and Rachel and Lee about that. We've had tons of people into the lab to see how to rear them. Rick has come down with his technician, and the folks at Springborn have been over, and some people from out of the country have been over. We're really happy to share that, and I think the guys in the insectary are really excited about getting this published, because if this really is going to be a surrogate species, then we need good quality sources of insects. It's a huge issue for any sort of harmonization is the quality of and availability of test organisms. So the more people who can rear this in a quality research laboratory, the better. So, yeah, we'd be happy to share rearing procedures. That'd be great. And I think that's why we're all here, to talk about the we're happy to share information on the bioassay itself.
Sean? Yes, the rearing procedure has been developed a long time ago by the FDA. It is in fact Mason, Texas, and there's a publication in 2002 and followed by experimentality with testing in mind.
Yeah, thanks.
I'll point out that it is an easy, relatively easy insect rear, and just ask if there's any reason why it shouldn't be accepted, data that should be accepted as a surrogate for lady beetles around the world. I mean, you know, they use CMAC here, and they use seven spots someplace else. I can't really see what the why there should be any conflict.
Right. The question is, why wouldn't CMAC be universally accepted as a surrogate species? And I think a lot of that's just education. Maybe people aren't familiar with why it makes such a good organism. I mean, it's easy to just come up with species, right? But you have to have a little bit more knowledge about the species that you want to test to understand whether there are robust rearing methods and bioassay methods for it. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, from the standpoint of the Americas, it's a great, great test organism. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really great question, actually. So the question was about the using an antibiotic in the Tier 1 study, right? Okay, very good. Just making sure I understood the question correctly. And, you know, I was a little worried about that, too. I guess what I would say to that is, you know, the diet components coming in from the manufacturer are not sterile, okay? And it's full of casein and wheat germ and soy protein, and it's carrying a load of lots of stuff, and it probably changes over time, too. I guess what I would say to that is that we use the same, I didn't show this, but part of the GLPs is to characterize the bioactivity. So when we create our aliquot, a test substance to add into the artificial diet, we are also taking the same aliquot and putting it into a Western corn rootworm diet, because if our test substance is rootworm active, and that also contains the antibiotic. It's a sensitive organism, and we can quickly elicit total mortality at the levels that we're testing. And so, you know, and the other thing I would say about that, these are neonates, right? They don't have a lot of body reserve. They're not going to live 7 days if they don't eat. And they're not going to live 7 days if they have disrupted midguts either. And so I would just offer those two things up in response to the use of it. It's a good question. Again, I would just say that we can still elicit a very acute toxic effect in the presence of that same antibiotic against our sensitive species. And so at least in that scenario, using the same antibiotic solution, we can still elicit acute effects against sensitive species. So.
So today I'll be presenting the advantage of harmonization to regulators. In talking about harmonization, of course, we're talking about the non-target effects of non-target the effects of non-target organisms to genetically engineered plants. And in talking about regulators, we are, of course, talking about the following agencies. In 1986, the Office of Science and Technology Policy published the Coordinated Framework for Regulation of Biotechnology, and the three agencies responsible for regulating these products are USDA, EPA, and FDA. The products are regulated according to their intended use, with some products being regulated under more than one agency. And if you've been to previous presentations from USDA, we can also see that we coordinated on the use of this graphic as well. Some background for the EPA. We are responsible for regulating the sale, distribution, and use of pesticides in order to protect human health and the environment. The definition of a pesticide is used to prevent, destroy, repel, or mitigate any pest. Therefore, this would include genetically engineered plants that would express a pesticidal property. And these are specifically registered within EPA's Office of Pesticide Programs in the Biopesticide and Pollution Prevention Division. The definition for plant incorporated protectant, this term was designated by the EPA to describe these substances that plants produced to protect them from damage caused by arthropod pests and diseases. It is defined as a pesticidal substance that is produced in the plant and the genetic material necessary for its production. It also includes the inert ingredient as well contained in the plant or produced thereof. In this presentation, I will specifically be focusing on plants that express an insecticidal protein. Going back to the coordinated framework for biotech products, this table shows the U.S. statutory authority of each regulated product. As you can see, some overlap. Only the USDA and EPA conduct ecological risk assessments of plants expressing insecticidal proteins as part of their regulatory process. One important distinction between the EPA and USDA is that the EPA regulates the PIP protein, but not the plant itself. And another distinction is that USDA will regulate herbicide-tolerant crops, while EPA will regulate the actual herbicide. Since USDA and EPA review similar non-target organism data as part of their ecological risk assessment, these agencies both utilize the tiered approach to the risk assessment process. The risk assessment, of course, in the risk assessment, risk is described as a function of exposure and hazard. And specifically for ecological risk assessment, the basis of it is the hazard of non-target organisms and exposure to the pesticidal substances. In making regulatory decisions, EPA evaluates the risk of pesticide use and balances these risks with the benefits derived from pesticide use. Ultimately, if the benefits of the pesticidal product outweigh the risks, then EPA considers the product to be in the interest of the public. The risk assessment is a tiered process, as noted before by our previous presenters, and the need of additional data is driven by specific triggers. And we also use the weight of evidence based on a comprehensive evaluation of the data. As you can see in Tier 1, these are high-dose screening level tests, usually conducted with a microbial-derived protein with an artificial diet in the laboratory. They are short-term, usually 7 to 14 days, and they use representative NTOs with an exposure of anywhere from 10 to 100 times the actual estimated environmental concentration. Only when there is a significant trigger, which is what we define as 50% mortality, is we move on to the Tier 2 testing, which is also a laboratory test where we will use plant material or a mixed diet, and we are starting to get closer to realistic exposure. If there is an adverse effect detected there, that is when we can proceed to Tier 3 or Tier 4.